Well, the presentation's getting going. My name's George Booty. I'm the executive director of the Land Stewardship Project in Minnesota, and we work on a. Let's see if I do this. Does that work? There we go. All right. In order to achieve this, we have a farm beginnings program that brings new entrants into agriculture. We work with healthcare institutions to make connections between them and farmers in the area. And we work on policy at the local, state, and federal level, and we do that with colleagues in the room. And I want to thank the Union of Concerned Scientists for inviting me to be part of this presentation. I do want to disclose a few things, just to be safe. We're part of the Food Alliance, the certification label, and that has connections to some farms and ranches that I'll mention, that we certify and receive fees from. And we also receive some money from Organic Valley to help us do our Farm Beginnings program. I want to talk first a little bit about agroecology. Okay. Agroecology, which is the relationship between people and other people and people in the land. And I would define that as both scientific research and farming and ranching using whole systems approaches that rely on ecosystem processes, emphasize adaptive management, produce healthful food, and renewable fiber and fuel from the land. Fuel's big in our neighborhood. And a result in quality of life for farmers, rural economic development, and ecosystem services. That's a mouthful, but those are all actually important concepts in what we mean by a whole system. I want to just touch for a moment, very briefly, on the industrial system. Farmers have done what we have asked them to do in this country and produce a lot of commodities, particularly corn and beans, as has been mentioned before, with tremendous yield increases from plant breeding. Now, one of the things that has been beneficial is that organic yields have increased at the same time as conventional yields have increased. And so organic yields are keeping pace. They're 80 to 100% of conventional yields, especially in dry years. So that's a good thing. Takes a lot of water, though, and a lot of other inputs to grow it this way. We separate animals from crops, put them in confinement facilities, requires antibiotics and other things. Sometimes sterilize strawberry fields. Takes a lot of oil, 10 kilocalories in for food, 1 kilocalorie out at this point. And now we're producing oil. 11% of corn and soybeans goes to fuel worldwide. Of course, there's a lot of control by big corporations with expensive inputs and a big policy apparatus. Complex consequences that we've talked about before, soil erosion, the Gulf of Mexico hypoxic zone. A lot of that nitrogen comes up here from the upper Mississippi River Basin on fields like this in the spring of the year. And EPA suggests we need to reduce nitrogen in the Mississippi River by 45 to 55% to reduce the size of the hypoxic zone. And that's only going to grow with global warming, chances are. Animal welfare issues. We're concerned now about E. coli and starting to rip out wildlife zones in California. This is a lake that's going out due to concerns about that. And, of course, there's health impacts by the kinds of fats and calories that we eat. So what are some principles? Previous speakers have touched on this. The foundation from an agroecological standpoint is healthy soil. That's the bedrock. And you can do that through managing soil organic matter. One of the ways that you get more soil organic matter is to have continuous living cover on the surface of the soil. Can do that through cover crops and annual crops and through various crop rotations and through pastures. It's important to diversify species. This has been addressed before. One of the ways you do that is through longer crop rotations, not just two crops, but five or more at least. And all of this combined with proper manure usage helps to create beneficial insects that help to manage the pest insects. And we have more nitrogen cycling in the soil rather than running off, and more water infiltrating rather than running off. And that means there's fewer waste products, because we don't want waste products. Everything should be usable. And finally, another important point is that animal welfare practices are part of a good agroecological system, where animals get to express their natural behaviors in terms of what they eat and how they are with each other. A few other things. We need to encourage adaptive management because we're learning a lot. There's going to be huge impacts from global climate change on organic systems as well as conventional systems. These are some of the things that we want to do. Particularly, we want to figure out how to balance yield. Instead of seeking maximum yield, balance that with other aspects, other multiple functions that we get from the land, climate change, water quality, and so forth. And to do this, we need to change policy, and we need to change purchasing in the marketplace. And another important part of an agroecological principles are just social relations. Quality of life on the farm and with nearby communities, treating workers fairly. That's why Food Alliance has fair treatment standards for workers as part of it. All of these are important aspects of agroecological principles. Just what are a few examples? This is Country Natural Beef. They grow their beef on rangelands in the western United States. They do send it to a feedlot, but they feed no more than 30% corn products, more unlike 80% corn products in a traditional feedlot system. This is Mike Ruprecht here. He and his wife Jennifer do grass-finished beef production, meaning that the animals don't go to a feedlot and they're in the pastures for their whole life eating this kind of material, plus some hay for the winter, of course. They market through Thousand Hills Cattle Company, which aggregates products, and that's part of the system that has to happen, is a system to deliver products from small and medium-sized farms to consumers. And this is Art Tickey's dairy cattle ranching, dairy cattle farming. 25% of farms in Wisconsin, dairy farms, are rotationally grazed. So that's pretty good. One of the things we want to see is beneficial fatty acids like omega-3s and conjugated linoleic acid. But we don't know very much about that. Unlike organic foods, we know less about how these really function, and particularly their impacts on human health. What is management-intensive grazing? It's a system of raising animals. Instead of doing this, you move them around fairly quickly. That allows the grass never to be brought down to the ground. It's higher. And if you do it right and allow enough time, birds can breed in those paddocks as well. So what about some research on examples and how this has impacts on the land? Well, this is the kind of erosion that we've been seeing lately in Minnesota and Iowa and Wisconsin due to the big storms that we've been having. And that can be as much as 5 to 8 tons per acre, even under a no-till farming system, which is the best that conventional agriculture has to offer. This is Art Tickey's farm. This pond did not fill up under a 15-inch rainfall in 24 hours. It filled up. It didn't overflow, I should say. That's pretty amazing. Now, we're going to see more of this with global climate change. This is exactly what's predicted, high-intensity rainfall, larger rainfalls, particularly at least in our part of the country. So we need systems that are protective. Here's some field-scale monitoring that we had done a few years back with our colleagues at the University of Minnesota. And this was a pretty significant storm for that period of time, pretty low losses on an organic pasture system. This is a visual representation of that. A very small amount of loss to a fairly big storm. That was probably 75% of the soil erosion from that area that year in this one storm. So we need these kinds of systems. Can rotational grazing protect water quality in other ways? If it's done properly, even though cattle have some access to the stream and are in the stream bank, under controlled circumstances, it could lead to a decrease in fecal coliform content and a decrease in turbidity. So these systems can be protective. We wanted to say then, we've seen these good examples on an individual farm. What about at a watershed scale? So we did some modeling with process modeling with the University of Minnesota in two 40,000 acre study areas in western Minnesota, here in southeastern Minnesota, and we looked at four scenarios compared to a baseline. Current trends, more corn and soybeans, best management practices in corn and soybeans, best management practices in corn and soybeans, scenario B, such things as reduced tillage, following nutrient recommendation practices, And then we looked at conversion to scenario C, which is an organic rotational system with a five-year crop rotation, corn, soybeans, small grains, and alfalfa. And then scenario D is a change to taking the steeper slopes out of production for row crop production, putting them in pastures to feed to animals, and increasing the number of animals in the watershed. And what we're seeing for with regard to the Gulf of Mexico hypoxia zone is it takes these diverse systems to potentially achieve the level of nutrient reduction in order to achieve the goals. Chuck was mentioning that before. So scenario C is an essentially organic system, and that's what it's going to take. We also looked at some of the other implications to changing land management at a watershed scale in terms of water runoff. You can see the decreases under scenarios C and D, costs from sediment, greenhouse gases. Now, you'll notice here that there's an increase in scenario D because we doubled the amount of cattle, hypothetically, and therefore there's more methane. But we think that that could be offset by carbon sequestration due to more pasture management and better health for fish, both cool water and warm water. There's been plenty of evidence that organic systems do in fact sequester carbon. Rodale study, 15 to 28% improvement over conventional farms. Now, agroecology needs to be fun. And one of the ways they have fun is birding. And Art Tickey here used to be able to identify maybe five species, but now he can identify 45 species going out with Tex Hawkins. So that's an example of what we want. We've seen potentially previous research shows an improvement of fivefold in terms of the number of species you can expect when you move from a simple system to a more diverse system, as you might have for an integrated crop and livestock system. And this is unsettled science, I guess you could say. But Union of Concerned Scientists Kate Clancy in their Greener Pastures book identified a number of potentially useful fatty acids that may be in pasture-raised products and that may be helpful for human health. More work to do, but it's suggestive. And we certainly know that these systems don't require antibiotics and that harmful E. coli are less likely to be produced in these systems than conventional corn-fed livestock products. And they do produce healthy farms where quality of life is fairly high and profit is good, particularly net profit. So just one of the ways that we need to deliver this food from farms to people, again, is through aggregated value chains where it's kind of a partnership. Instead of money moving up the supply chain to the highest bidder on top, it's shared amongst the participants in the value chain, from the farmers to the processors to the distributors and the retailers. Organic Valley is a co-op that has about 1,300 members around the United States, a great example of that. A couple of small entities in Minnesota. That are also Food Alliance certified as well as organic certified. Frozen vegetables, Nyman Ranch has gathers humanely raised pork. So I just want to mention that there's a group called Healthcare Without Harm that's a great partner in this, and they are interested in getting more food, locally raised food, sustainably raised food into healthcare institutions, be it Kaiser Permanente, Catholic Healthcare West, Mayo Clinic, St. Luke's Hospital in Duluth, Minnesota. So it's a good strategy. There's a whether we're talking small grains, orchards, kind of very diversified livestock systems with multiple species, or season extension approaches like high tunnels for vegetables. We know that these systems really can work, and in fact we're going to need them to work because we're facing big challenges with global warming impacts on agriculture, reduced energy availability, reduced water availability. The Ogallala Aquifer, which is in the central part of the United States, is depleting at the rate of 10 feet per year. Some places already don't have very much water from it. Just an example of the kind of challenges that we're faced. So I'll sum up by saying that Paul Otten, who has Natura Farms up near us, likes to say it's time to move from the pharmacist to the farmer with regard to good health. And I think Chuck's presentation indicated just exactly how we can do that. So in order to have the farmer be our pharmacist, we need healthy soils and we need agroecological systems functioning along with the social systems that make them work. And I think that if we utilize the kinds of principles that I was talking about earlier and that others have talked about, we'll get more diverse farms raising more food on smaller plots of land rather than these very extensive approaches. And at the same time, livestock and healthy livestock raised on pastures and on rangelands are great. And I think we'll learn more about how good they are. Now, there's plenty of challenges upcoming, and we have a lot to learn from a science perspective, and we need your support to purchase goods from the institutions that you're part of and to assist us with policy change, because these kinds of systems aren't going to happen with our current policy structure where we support commodity production. One of the programs that I think is useful is the Conservation Stewardship Program that points toward how we support farmers for producing ecosystem benefits rather than the commodities that they produce, and that's just one example. So I will close there and thank you for your attention.
Would you all come up? Well, thank you to all four of you. I'm going to have this fall down. So we have 15 minutes or so for questions. And just while you're all thinking about your questions, I want you to remember that there are surveys, evaluations of this session back on the table in the back. APHA is really, in the environment section, is really encouraging all participants to fill out these surveys. You'll be entered into a raffle for a free APHA membership for next year, and it will help them in their fundraising with foundations. So please do fill out those surveys. You can just leave them filled out on the back, on the table in the back. So are there questions for any and all of the speakers today? In the pink. So the question is the feasibility of small farms and pasture-based systems to feed our population.
It's a good question. There's
Do you want to come up?
Oh, sure. All right.
Good question. A lot of debate. I think the yields that we're seeing from organic systems suggest that it may be possible to feed ourselves with these kinds of approaches, both with organic and pasture-based systems. Around the world, about 60% of animal protein comes from pasture-based systems, so it's not maybe as unusual in elsewhere around the world as it is here. It may mean, however, that we need to adapt our diet in order to do this. Maybe we eat less meat because it takes longer to raise meat with a pasture-based system than it does in a corn-fed, highly energy-dense system. So maybe we have less meat available in total, but higher quality meat for what we do eat. So I think there's going to be some adaptations that we're going to have to make in our diet in order to make this feasible. But I do think it potentially is feasible.
I live in Northeast Oregon in cattle country. I've got a lot of dear friends that are in the business. Cattle walk by my place all the time. And there's tremendous progress being made all through the Pacific Northwest in creating a viable grass-based beef industry. Remember, about 60% of the pounds that get put on our beef are getting put back on, you know, family-scale farms spread all over the country. It's that last third to 40% of the pounds of beef that get put on in feedlots where the whole beef part of our food system gets concentrated. The probably the biggest single impediment to success in keeping more of those cattle longer out there across the country where on smaller farms is slaughterhouse facilities. If there's no place to process your beef in 400 miles or 500 miles, it becomes a huge problem when you might only have two beef or four beef a week. So we're working in our county on a kind of a cooperative effort to create a community-controlled USDA-inspected slaughter facility. But as someone who's, I've lived in several parts of rural America, all across the country, the lack of slaughter facilities for not just beef, but pork and small livestock is the number one constraint.
I think I'd like to partly reiterate what both George and Chuck said. We did a study looking at this that we published in April for hogs. We look most closely at hogs and dairy, and there's some what's called lower feed conversion efficiency. It takes a little bit more pasture, for example, to put on the same amount of weight on an animal as it does for grain. Part of that is when the animals have more freedom to move, which is partly a humane issue and also a health issue, they metabolize more and they use more for energy production. So you have some reductions in efficiency there, but you also have less antibiotic use. So there may be some trade-offs, but they're really quite fairly small in most cases with some of these systems. For example, hog hoop houses sometimes approach the efficiency of hog CAFOs. But in terms of overall benefit to the farmer, they're often is cost-effective to the farmer and produce pretty close to what other systems do. So, and I think we also have to remember that most of our research effort has been going towards industrial agriculture. We put a tremendous, both in our land grant institutions and others, we put a tremendous amount of research effort into making these CAFOs work. We put very little research effort into making these alternatives work. So it's somewhat speculative, but we have to wonder if we put, you know, a significant amount of effort into some of these alternatives, I'm hopeful that we can get them to be at least as efficient as CAFOs in these other ways. And then, of course, we have to remember what all the, you know, negative externalities are from industrial agriculture, including animal production. It's not a free ride. We're hurting productive systems like with the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. We're hurting fisheries. So, you know, we have to take all those things into account, not just a narrow definition of efficiency.
Since everybody wants to get into this, I think it is important to understand that we have an industrialized agriculture in this country in order to produce more food. I mean, we produce about as many cows right now as we produced at the turn of the last century. You can see charts of, say, the number of pigs that are grown in Iowa through the period in which they were produced primarily on small farms until today, when some major percentage of the pigs are produced in industrial facilities, and the total number of pigs is, you know, more or less the same. So industrialization is not a way of increasing the amount of food. It responds to other pressures in the food system, and I mean I don't think that we are that we're going to that by moving away from industrial systems, in some way we're not going to be able to produce enough food. And in addition to that, I think we have a lot of opportunities for growing food that we're not exploiting now that we will be able to exploit in the future as we better develop, say, for example, the pasture-raised beef systems, which literally could be grown on in all parts of the country. So, but I think there is a kind of misconception that industrialization is done to increase the amount of food, the number of pigs that you grow in a particular place, and that's not the case.
Other questions? Here in front.
Are
Anybody want to handle the political and business end challenges?
I just think that that's an enormous question, and there's no doubt that our current system is global, enormous, very simple, very efficient, and I guess my observation would be that those are the same features that we associate with our banking system. It's global, interconnected, huge, very efficient, and now is in meltdown. So one of my observations is that the system as a whole is likely to crumble. The agricultural system, our hyper-tuned agricultural system, could crumble as our financial system is doing, rather than there being kind of an evolving mosaic of changes going into the future that, as you said, will have some winners and some losers that are kind of difficult to predict from right now. But I do think one of the, what I hope would be one of the losers would be too big a corporations that control too much of the food system, and rather than make us efficient, make us vulnerable.
Just a quick comment. I think we're going to see different parts of the food supply create economic opportunities for different sorts of players. I think that where small, typically small and local farmers have a huge economic advantage is in fresh fruits and vegetables that need to be picked vine ripe to be most flavorful and most nutrient dense. It's very difficult for large corporations to get control of all of the assets around all of the cities where that's possible. On the other hand, I suppose people that live here in San Diego have as close to a year-round local supply of at least some fruits and vegetables. But for the majority of Americans, there's a potential to have a substantial local presence in their diet from particularly fresh fruits and vegetables for 4, 5, and at most 6 months per year. We need our five to nine servings of fruits and vegetables every day, including in the winter. And I think that's where a larger scale food industry that can source fruits and vegetables where they're grown most efficiently, without fighting a lot of pests and bacterial blights that require a lot of fungicides. They need to grow food, grow tomatoes and grow grapes where they grow well without a lot of manipulation of the environment, but then we've got to get better at preserving them in ways so that they can be transported at lower energy cost and retain more of their innate flavors and nutrients. And I'm pleased to say that there's getting to be some serious effort in this regard. I, for one, would much rather have a high-quality, well-preserved berry grown in the Pacific Northwest than buy Chilean blackberries in the winter from Safeway.
That's a really good question. I mean, there's no doubt that they're going to exercise enormous attempted control, and that they already are. I mean, Monsanto, among other seed companies, is buying up small vegetable seed houses, and some of those plants are becoming unavailable if they choose not to keep them on the marketplace anymore. That's one example. Another example, just in Minnesota, we were helping some farmers and citizens organize on a large CAFO dairy farm that was coming in, and there was a local town council meeting, township council meeting, and there were about 250 people there. There wasn't room for the local citizens because there were so many representatives from the agribusiness companies and the state politicians who were there to say, pass this thing through. So they exercised that control throughout. So it's up to us as citizens to really organize together and work together through our organizations like we have here to deal with that.
we've been talking a lot about the U.S. situation, and this is an area where I think we should also be thinking globally, because the companies that have a tremendous amount of concentration and control in the U.S., some of them already exert a lot in terms of distribution of grain, for example, globally. But in terms of seed companies, that there's an effort to expand into developing countries where local supply is really critical, where it's a matter of life and death for a lot of those smaller farmers. And there have been a number of studies recently, one that just came out that the UN Environment Program sponsored. There have been studies out of the University of Michigan and others that all show that organic production works better and with lower input costs for these poor farmers in developing countries, and produces more in most cases than trying to impose industrial agriculture in areas like sub-Saharan Africa. So that question about corporate control is going to be especially important in developing countries that are suffering the most from lack of food security.
We're running out of time, but I think we have time for one more quick question. I saw a hand here.
Couple resources. I'll just mention our program. We have a Farm Beginnings program that's designed to do exactly that. We've had about 350 people go through it in the last 11 years. Our last survey was that 60% are farming, have started farming in some way or another. We're licensing that to groups in other states to utilize. There are other such programs around the country. And there's a new provision in the Farm Bill will be funded from a mandatory standpoint for the first time, called the Beginning Farmer Rancher Development Program, that provides money for programs that will train beginning farmers, some of whom come out of the city with no real farming experience. Some of them are people returning to the farm or who worked on a farm but never owned it. So there are resources out there, and there are some success stories. One of the issues right now is land prices, either due to development around urban areas or because of high commodity prices. They're not as high right now, but when they're high, it increases land values, and so that makes it tough for people to own enough acreage. But the systems that are being talked about here are lower capital to get started, and that's one of their big advantages from a beginning farmer standpoint. Well, it depends on who drives it. And not to the degree that we would have wanted it to be. So it really is inherent upon us, I would say, in the sustainable ag community to drive that program so that it creates new farmers doing these kinds of systems rather than the industrial system.
Well, and as we are so close to having a new administration, I think, I would leave with that idea that there's going to be, we had this farm bill, it passed at the end of, essentially at the end of an administration in a congressional session, and there will be a lot of implementation that will need to be done in the next Congress and with the next administration. So maybe we could leave with that. Thank you all for coming. I really appreciate it. Turn in your surveys at the back of the room. Thanks. Oops. That's not what I wanted to do. Get back to.